Hello, Foreign Entanglements viewers. I'm Dr. Rob Farley from the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. And with me today is Professor Tom Nichols. Tom, you want to introduce yourself?
I'm Tom Nichols. I'm a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College, whose views I do not represent in this conversation. And I'm an adjunct at the Harvard Extension School, a senior associate at the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs in New York.
I should hasten to add, and I think I am required to do this now, that I also, my views are also not representative of either the Patterson School, the University of Kentucky, or the Commonwealth of Kentucky. I should probably toss in two or three more organizations
I
there.
End of no sane person, me, so.
Right. Exactly. So we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff today, but I think we're going to use this as a jumping off point. I'm not going to go ahead and call them revelations yet. They are sort of perspectives from Leon Panetta's new book on the Obama administration, which a lot of people are noting appears to be quite critical about a lot of major points. You know, when everything else comes in and we're able to digest the whole thing, we'll probably find there are other arguments in there. I know Bob Gates, for example, disliked that impression of his book. But this comes back to one of the things that Foreign Entanglements viewers will know that I spoke about with David Gartenstein-Ross a few weeks ago, which was this role of credibility and reputation in international politics. Leon Panetta, as you have suggested, really believes in credibility in international politics and really believes on the importance of credibility in international politics and really believes that Obama has screwed up. And it's my sense that you share his view of this. So maybe you wanted to start by talking a little bit about where you think Obama has made serious errors with respect to this and sort of where Panetta's view of that fits into your assessment of the Obama administration.
Well, for my money, the most shocking parts of Panetta's interview actually had to do with Russia. Some of the stuff about, well, I said to arm the rebels and I said to leave a residual force in ISIS and all that. You kind of expect that. I mean, we're in the middle of a failed foreign policy. This is the end of the second term of presidential administration. Some of this was just going to be score settling. You know, if only I had been listened to, right? Washington's always full of those memoirs that, boy, hey, you know. I mean, Bush had them, you know, McClellan's book and the guy, Mike, you know, you're doing a heck of a job, Brownie guy, who tried to explain how, you know, Katrina wasn't really his fault. That happens at the end of an administration. I think we should talk about that. It's a worrisome thing in and of itself. But when Panetta gets talking about places like Russia and he says, we're sending them mixed messages and we're not dealing with them from a position of strength, there's two ways to look at that. One is that Panetta had, like all Washington policymakers, has been sucked into the notion erroneously that reputation matters. I disagree with that interpretation. I think reputation does matter, and I think at the very least you can make the argument that if all of these decision makers think it matters, then it matters.
Right.
But I certainly think that it matters in Moscow. I think part of the problems that we're having with the Obama administration's foreign policy in Europe in particular is that Putin thinks, and I'm really worried about this in terms of a conflict between the United States or between NATO and Russia breaking out, that Putin thinks the candy store is open for the next 2 years because he thinks he has taken the measure of the Obama administration and that the reputation issue is now firmly entrenched and that he's going to make a miscalculation because he doesn't understand that the American government is bigger than just one president at any given time. But I found that really disturbing, this notion that Panetta is really concerned that we basically have squandered away our reputation, our credibility, our ability to fall through. And to link this back to the Middle East, he repeatedly invokes the failure, to follow through on the red line in Syria. Now, a year ago, I and other people in print argued that if we didn't follow through on the red line in Syria, there were a lot of other, I don't know, should I use the word dominoes? let's stay
you
away.
You should hesitate to use that word. You should hesitate, yes.
But that there were a lot of that there would be a lot of second and third order effects from not following through on the red line issue in places that we wouldn't expect them, like in Europe, like in Asia. And I think that's happened.
If I can pause you, right? I mean, first, I totally agree with you with respect to how interesting it is. Whether it's negative, positive, I mean, I think that there are probably potential solutions to this issue where people leave an administration and then write these interesting tell-alls, right? Yeah, some of them are really valuable. Like Bob Gates' book has its issues. It's a really interesting book, and there's a lot of interesting stuff, and it's good that we have this stuff out. And there were a lot of books that came out during the Bush administration, which were also pretty interesting views into how an administration sort of viewed its foreign policy issues. But I guess to start with, on the Syria red line, what does it mean to follow through? Like, what action could the Obama administration have taken that we would have said was following through? And the reason I ask this is because, I mean, you know that I study air power, and a lot of times, would some volley of airstrikes that would have left Assad in power been sufficient to follow through and then have these credibility, reputation-enhancing effects? Or would you have found the United States sort of really tied up in this Syria conflict in a way that it otherwise wouldn't have been in order to enhance credibility and reputation, right? So what do we need to do in order to maintain this nebulous thing that we're calling credibility and reputation?
I think that's a great question. First, let me back up and agree with you completely that whatever the flaws of these memoirs, you and I both, I think, come as more of us in political science do than we're sometimes willing to admit. We come from a strongly qualitative background in addition to the other things that we do. And memoirs are gold. You don't take them at face value. You don't simply open them up and say, well, they speak for themselves. But they give you this kind of lodestone from which to start extrapolating other things and to do to do what journalists do, in effect, which, of course, in most political science departments, that's a poisonous accusation, right? When you're writing like a journalist.
Right.
But the fact is, to unravel cause and effect and to establish hypotheses and causal relationships, we have to do the spade work. We have to do the detective work like everybody else. Now, with that said...
Right, well, if I could pause you for a second, with Gates' memoir, it was really important that he was thinking in terms of inter-service conflict between the Army and the Air Force, right? There was no reason for him to lie about that, right? It's just, and my argument was about inter-service conflict, and he was clearly thinking about it, right?
But the other thing about the Gates and Panetta and all the other memoirs is they're checkable. It's not like there are claims in them that we're never going to know are true, because there will be declassifications, there will be records, unless, there's a Sandy Berger in this administration who tries to walk out with the records in his socks. The fact of the matter is, we're going to have things like appointment books and notes and diaries. So it's a great part of the historical record that I think is important grist for political scientists to work with. As to your question about what to do about this reputational issue, I when this first broke, I got asked this question a million times. Well, what would you do? My dodge on this was always to say, look, I'm not an operational planner, so I'm not going to sit down and come up with a list, of targets. On the other hand, my goals at the end of any campaign would be leave Assad militarily worse off than he already is, degrade the ability to move weapons, forces, and chemical weapons around. Of course, we're all crowing about what a great success OPCW had right up until we get to that, except for the four undeclared. You notice that every time OPCW talks about its successes, it adds the magic word declared. We've removed 97% of declared. Well, okay, that's like saying I paid 100% of my declared taxes. Okay, fair enough. Mm-hmm. Now, with that said, the other thing that I think would have been very important about Syria strikes and also including limiting their ability to fly. I mean, I was in favor of a no-fly zone 2 years ago, mm-hmm. which would actually have helped us with ISIS, because it would have put a constant presence in the air that would have allowed us to have a better idea what's going on the ground. But the most important part is that once Assad used chemical weapons, a strike on anything, even if it was a hand grenade, would have established the precedent that from now on, the United States and its allies have established that intervening in Syria against the regime for its behavior, that that door is now open. And my biggest problem with the president backing off from this is that he inadvertently reaffirmed some, what I think is an antiquated notion of Syrian sovereignty, as though somehow this couldn't be done because it was so transgressive. I think we needed to kick that door in to leave open the possibility of future actions. I think the people who ask, how will this stop this all? Mm-hmm. How will this solve this problem right now with one air campaign? We're prejudicing the question because they already knew the answer they wanted, which is, I don't want to do this. And I'll just, and then I'll stop. I'll get off this rant. But I think that a big part of what's really gotten between my teeth about a lot of the arguments about punishing Syria was that there was so much prejudicial expert advice. You know me, I'm big on experts and expertise. But I think a lot of people who said, well, this is going to be too hard and it's going to take, you know, this many sorties and there's this much air defense. All of those objections boiled down to, I just really don't want to.
Right.
Oh, I don't think they were really fair objections.
Right. Right. Some of the objections, and they did sort of, you know, talk about the air defenses and so forth, did come down to, and wanted to convey, this is a bigger job than you think it is, right? It is a bigger job to install a no-fly zone than you think it is, right? Especially if we're sort of following up on Northern Watch and Southern Watch. But they did kind of, and then, you know, even saying it's a bigger job was also, you know, the people who were saying that were people like me who didn't want to do it. Well, let me tell you.
I was told that about Libya. By the way, I remember somebody, more than one person, people that were retired military, who knew better, would say, mm-hmm. Oh, Tom, you know, those Libyan air defenses, those are going to be tough. And I said, look, if that's true, I want a total refund on every dollar we've ever paid for national defense. I said, you're talking about a Navy that was going to contest the Mediterranean with the Soviet Union. And if you can't bomb Libya, then something's gone terribly wrong.
A drone might get shot down. But, I mean, with reputation in mind, and with, because reputation, what we're really talking about in reputation is what other people learn about what you're doing, right? The lessons that they choose to draw about you. So the situation in which we get involved in serious airstrikes against Syria, and that include everything you need to do for a no-fly zone, like degrading the SAM network, which is doable, right? It's manageable. They have these giant bus-sized SAMs that we can avoid and then kill when we need to, whatever. But the Assad regime doesn't fall, right? I mean, what kind of lessons does Assad, do people in the Middle East, do Putin draw from that, right? Isn't it just as likely they sit there and they draw the lesson that, hey, the United States is willing to engage in harmless, maybe mildly expensive uses of air power, but isn't willing to actually put any blood, any serious money on the table to accomplish the foreign policy aims that it wants. And we have this, right? They are willing to go to war against Assad, but they're not willing to do anything about actually winning that war, right? And the issue, you know, there are lots of good reasons why the United States would take one step and not the other step, right? But the question is, what are these other people who are not Americans, what lessons are they going to draw about this? And, you know, aren't they just going to take the lessons that they want to take about United States behavior and do the things that they want to do, which in the case of Putin is, you know, go into the candy store and take all of this stuff because he thinks the United States is weak, right? He's going to learn the same. My thinking is he's going to learn the same lesson either way because that's the lesson he wants to learn, right? Whether you have the red line or whether you just leave Assad in power after a few airstrikes.
But that's not fair, Rob, because you're criticizing airstrikes that never happened. You're saying, what lesson would they have taken away from pinprick strikes that really were indecisive and inconclusive? We'll never know because we never did it. And my problem isn't the lesson they would have learned from doing the airstrikes. It's the lesson they took away from the entire diplomatic body language that surrounded not doing them, where the president appeared to make a decision. Then he takes a walk with Dennis McDonough, and all of a sudden that decision goes out the window, and he puts Kerry out there to thunder about the moral the moral contemptibility of what's happened, and then pulls the rug out from under John Kerry. And, you know, if I were sitting in Moscow, I'd say, these guys don't know what they're doing. But wait, maybe we'll get a really savage statement on this from who? Jen Psaki? Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to get a hashtag from Marie Harf? I mean, it's not just the binary decision of, are we bombing, are we not bombing? It's, are we bombing with a diplomatic message
with enthusiasm? Are we bombing with enthusiasm?
Well, okay, you know, are we bombing with enthusiasm? But again, we'll never know. I mean, 200 cruise missile strikes look enthusiastic if you're Assad. If you're Assad hanging on by your fingernails in a tough civil war, and suddenly you're out of the air game, for example, you know, you're fighting a different kind of war. And if from now on, everybody fighting, good guys, bad guys, pro-American, pro-Western, anti-Western, Islamist, if they know that every time they look up, the only thing in the sky is Western air power, it's going to make a difference. And I think it's going to make a difference to Putin. But again, here we're arguing about the airstrikes that didn't happen.
Right.
My concern is,
but if you're,
did we pull back from this? Mm-hmm. But we pulled back with this terrible kind of equivocation and clutchy sort of, we don't know what we're doing. But, and we meant it, but we don't mean it. And
but if you're going to be a critic of decisions that were made, right? And I agree with you. The Obama administration approached this decision in a really weird. You know, I was writing, look, we're going to bomb Syria because that's what's going to happen because that's the way all the. And then suddenly it was turned around. It was turned around in a very weird way, and there were obviously things going on in the White House and the national security bureaucracy that didn't make any sense. But you know, it seems to me that if you're, and I don't want to get too political sciencey, if you're going to make, whether you're Tom Nichols or Leon Panetta, you're going to make a critique of decision and sort of associate outcomes with how that decision was made, it has to be more than, well, we don't know what would have happened if the airstrikes had been made, right? I mean, you have to have some sort of better theory about how airstrikes on Syria, and I agree with you, airstrikes on Syria likely do change a lot of the realities on the ground in Syria, and they likely do enable the rebels, although they may actually also enable ISIS, right, because ISIS benefits from the Syrians not having air power available to them.
Absolutely.
So, but, yeah, you've got to have a better argument than that for how this affects not just Putin, because the same story is being told about China and how they were moving oil rigs into the East China Sea and the South China Sea based on U.S. behavior, right? You got to have a better story than we don't know what would have happened because the airstrikes never happened.
Okay, but Rob, I'm gonna call a foul here and say that's a better story than here's my entire explanation and analysis of why the strikes that didn't happen wouldn't have mattered if they did happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense, you're spinning out a more hypothetical than I am. You're talking about a set of airstrikes that never took place, and you're assuming that they would look a certain way, that they would then fail, that they would then have the following reputational effects, and so on. But that's really not fair, because again, there's war is a matter of so many contingencies, and split decisions as the process goes on. That's why, as you and everybody else knows, I hate the how does this end arguments. You know, I would love to, I always like to, you know, go back to like World War II or 1950 in the Korean War and say, well, now, how does this, tell me how this ends? What does the new German regime look like 6 years from now? You know, that kind of stuff. So I think it's unfair to say if the strikes had gone this way, we don't know that. But going back to the reputational issue, I think part of the problem is that we're sending a very clear message to everybody, to Assad, to ISIS, to Putin, to the Chinese. And I think to try to take the Syrian red line in isolation, which is not what Panetta did. I mean, in the course of 5 days of interviews, he's gone from red line to Russia to China. If you take all these together, there is one message that comes out of the administration very clearly, and that is that domestic politics trumps everything. And domestic partisan politics trumps everything. And I actually think, let me just be a little more fair to the Obama administration, that since the end of the Cold War, without the, I don't know, let's call it Hillary Clinton's organizing principle, without that paradigm, whatever you want to call it, that increasingly through the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations, the tendency more and more has been to listen to loyalists and support on foreign policy issues, to listen to the loyalists inside the base. Because, of course, until foreign policy goes wrong, Americans don't care about it.
Right.
And so in the absence of an overarching problem like the Cold War, in this political vacuum, you gravitate toward the loyalists. I think that's partly how the Bush people walked right into that vacuum, that bubble where, you know, people like Doug Feith were the, you know, the geniuses of the future of Iraq. But I think that that has reached its apotheosis in doing foreign policy with campaign staff.
You know, it's that's really there's a bunch of stuff there, and
I think that's one of the things. I'm sorry to interrupt. Just to say that I think this is one of the things that Panetta, if I'm being a good Sovietologist here and reading between Panetta's lines, I think one of the things that Panetta's upset about is, look, I'm an old Washington hand. I've been around here for 40 years. I was a congressman. I was OMB. I was this. I was that. And I have to go into rooms and get overridden by, you know, 25-year-old staff. I mean, if I were Panetta and I had to sit through a meeting with Tommy Vietor, I'd be pissed.
Right. I guess two things that are kind of interesting coming out of this. One is, I think first, you know, there shouldn't be any question. It's basically fundamentally right that in the absence of overwhelming systemic pressures, right, of some sort of overwhelming pressure of the Cold War, which is, you know, overwhelming for a whole ton of different reasons, for structural reasons, for ideological reasons, whatever, that presidents are going to be more responsive to domestic than they are to the international pressures. Just because the international pressures are different and weird and harder to interpret, it doesn't really understand. And so, yeah, I mean, what's kind of interesting, and this is a perspective you're not part of, right, but being, you know, I don't know whether I want to call myself a man of the left, but some people certainly say that I am. The left, a lot of the left really hates the Obama administration's foreign policy, right? And, you know, you have to debate what are you going to talk about, what is the base, what are the extremists, but there are a lot of people who are really nervous about, you know, not only this, not so much, but about drone policy more broadly and so far. And for those people, it's really hard, you know, what you just said about Obama making foreign policy for the base and the loyalists, they'd be like, what are you talking about? We've been left out in the cold, right? Although I think that that's probably true of various factions in a lot of places. But
go back to the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. Who hated the Bush administration policy in the Middle East more than the traditional old school realists?
Right.
The people that you would have identified as the kind of Nixonian, kind of late Reagan, you know, people who identify themselves as the core of the Republican Party. I mean, I don't know what I am anymore. I identify myself these days with the liberal internationalists. I mean, I've, you know, although I don't think very much of the way Susan Rice handles her job, let's say, you know, as a in terms of her public diplomacy. But who were the people? I mean, for years I was assigning Samantha Power's book in my class, in my Harvard class. You know, I was following Anne Marie Slaughter. I remember telling students, if this person has now become the head of policy planning, you know, this is a big deal. I mean, I was following all of these interventionists, and yet I'm most of the people I think on social media who follow either one of us would say, well, you may be a man of the left, but Nichols is clearly a man of the right. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what that means anymore in foreign policy. I mean, I get called a neocon all the time. I don't even know what that means. I don't know that word has any.
Well, I don't think anybody would have guessed that, for example, you know, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer would be associated with the sort of the most vicious left critiques of this administration, right? But that's clearly what they have become associated with, and you know, both sort of by their own devices and because of where they found themselves with respect to particular debates.
You know what I think is interesting about this, and this is where we intersect with political science, I think. One of the best explanations I ever heard in a non-attribution environment, so I'm not taking credit for this, but I'm not going to say who said it.
That's okay. Nobody ever watches the show anyway. So
that's, well, you know, but all right, but you and I do. but there, some years ago, there was a foreign policy specialist who said he explained Walton Mearsheimer and some of the other hardcore realists as going into opposition because they were so mad that no one listens to them, that they were so mad about the Iraq war where no one listened to them. And that they are that then, of course, when the Bush people left and the liberal internationalists, the kind of power Rice Slaughters came in, right, once again, no one listened to them. And what they're really pissed about is it's just a temper tantrum that no one listens to us. God damn it. And so you're all stupid and wrong. And I thought that was just such a brilliant explanation of this, and it was in the context of trying to explain the Walton Mearsheimer book about Israel. And this guy's explanation was, it's not that they hate the Jews or the Israelis, It's that they're so confounded by the fact that no one will listen to them that they're the only explanation they're left with is that it must be a grand conspiracy.
Well, yeah, people have been
throwing that's a hilariously but also kind of on point explanation of their sort of vitriol about foreign policy.
People have been hating on the sort of the Big E foreign policy establishment since the night. Even since before Vietnam, people have been hating on the Big E foreign policy establishment while also sort of constructing what that Big E establishment was supposed to be looking like. And you know, and this was weird. So during the Cold War, there actually was much more continuity in that establishment than there is now, where you basically got the same foreign policy from Democratic and Republican administrations. But yeah, it's discontent with a foreign policy establishment that really just is uninterested in what they're selling.
Which does bridge back to this: are they uninterested in kind of academics in general, or is it just these guys? But before we go toward that, I think we both would agree, however, despite the Cold War, this is something I've been saying for years, is that the difference between Democratic and Republican administrations and foreign policy is, you know, tiny. I mean, it's really not the difference that people think it is.
There are many on the left who would join you in that critique, right? Glenn Greenwald feels the same way.
I think I'm making in some ways, a very leftist critique that America, I would even extend this to domestic policy, America does not produce presidents capable of serious challenges to the status quo in anything.
Right.
Now, as a conservative, I'm okay with that. I mean, you know, that's kind of my thing, is not challenging the status quo, because the nature of conservatives is to conserve. With that said, let's also not romanticize and say that, there was a golden age of bipartisanship in foreign policy. I'm old enough to remember the Reagan era. I don't know what the hell Chris Matthews is talking about with that warm, fuzzy Reagan and O'Neill bullshit that he goes on about. I remember the early 1980s. I remember O'Neill leaving with ashes in his mouth and nothing but vitriol about how stupid and dangerous Ronald Reagan was. So there was never that bipartisanship, but there was a kind of general agreement that there was a single enemy whose conflict, in which our conflict had to define certain priorities, whether we liked it or not.
Right.
That's different than bipartisanship, but at least it was an ordering principle.
There was vicious bipartisanship, and you know, all the way from the 1950s, there's pretty vicious bipartisanship. You know, in retrospect, that partisanship. Yes, exactly. In retrospect, that partisanship seems to be over a very narrow band of opinion that's shifting back and forth. But that doesn't mean that the partisanship is not vitriolic and angry and furious, right? But it does seem to be over a very narrow period. I'm going to tell a story right now, and I want to see what you think about it. And it goes back to Panetta, and it then sort of leads into our conversation about political science. For 40 years, we had this Cold War thing going on, and there were very few things that either the Soviet Union or the United States could actually do in this Cold War. There were some fundamental strategic, structural things that, that just aren't going to change about the relationship, until the other one actually falls apart, which the Soviets hoped we would do, and eventually they do, whatever. It is from this period that we develop, and I should say, I'm completely outside of this. I was a mere high school student when the Soviet Union collapsed, so I'm innocent of this. But it is during this period that we develop this obsession with credibility and reputation that remains in the old Washington hands, like Panetta, because the credibility and the reputation is the only thing you could actually affect on a day-to-day basis, right? You couldn't change the number of Soviet ICBMs. You couldn't change the number of Soviet tanks. You couldn't really change the numbers on the American side. What you could think about on a day-to-day basis was the optics, was sort of the elements of the negotiation and how they looked to people and what the Soviets might be thinking about what you're doing right now. And so this is how, in the policymaking set, these ideas about reputation, credibility, and everything else become embedded, and why Panetta still is drawn to them and still finds them to be deeply consequential. And I'm not going to implicate you in this, but I think you're going to implicate yourself. So that's, and this I think will lead then to our conversation about the difference between political science and policymakers. But this is how I explain this puzzle of why is it that policymakers, almost to an individual, but perhaps except for the current president of the United States, think that credibility and reputation are really, really important to how the United States deals with problems on the international stage.
All right, let me start at the top of your argument and just disagree with. I don't disagree with you as much as you think, because I think the Cold War added a lot of octane to that whole reputation problem. But I think if you go all the way back to the Peloponnesian War, I mean, Athens and Sparta, you mean the speeches of Pericles, the Spartan councils. I mean, they are thinking seriously about, that. Think about why the Athenians and the Spartans thought it was going to be a short war, because they thought the other guy was going to fold because they just assumed that they were weenies, right?
Right.
That, oh, the Athenians are a bunch of, weak, luxury addicted lotus eaters, and we're the tough guy. I mean, this thing about reputation long predates the Cold War, and I would argue that this comes out of an understanding of the human sciences. Reputation matters in international relations because it matters to human beings. That's a fundamental outgrowth of being a human being. Think about why markets work, right? How do markets work? It through iterated action in which you develop a reputation for paying your debts or providing a quality service. Things that human beings play iterated games with each other all the time. So this notion that the Cold War simply created, I love Dan Nexon's whole thing about the reputation fairy, that I use that expression all the time, that the Cold War simply gave birth to the reputation fairy, I think really ignores, this is where I think political scientists forget that the subject they're studying is this, are human beings. Human beings believe in reputation because that's in our nature. With that said, I will agree with you that the Cold War added a huge amount of voltage to that problem for two reasons. And the two reasons I see mostly are one, the existence of a very strong ideology on the part of our opponent. Now, I don't disagree. The United States was an ideological state, right? The United States was formed on an ideology rather than on blood or soil or ethnic ties, which, as a complete aside, I assume we both hate the word homeland.
Oh yes, oh good Lord.
Ugh.
I even hate the series Homeland, but
Well, oh, the series was ridiculous. Let's face it, the series was ridiculous. But every time I hear the word homeland, I think, oh, that must have sounded so much better in the original German. But because the Soviets had a codified, rigid, predictive ideology that was constantly searching their opponents for evidence of conformity to their ideology, we had to be very careful about not accidentally playing into, I'm not going to say their operational code. I never thought that literature was very good, but into their ideological preconceptions. I mean, I've talked with Soviet military officers, and I mean Soviet, not Russian, back in the day. I was a little older than you when the Berlin Wall fell. That who really said things like, we were told in the 1970s that your army was basically a bunch of drug addicted, homosexual, losers that we were going to, and because that was a predisposition into their ideology that the West is decadent, it's weak, and so on. So I think Western decision makers were acutely aware of not accidentally playing into Soviet ideology about reputation. The other problem, and I think the other thing that really informed the reputation problem and gave it a lot more salience during the Cold War, was that we didn't know enough about the internal processes of the other guy. So, excuse me. So we had to always go on gut and instinct and intuition and second order analysis to say, what is he thinking about what we're thinking about what he's thinking? Because we didn't have an entree into those processes. And I think if you actually go back into the 18th and 19th centuries, you'll find that there were, during the Napoleonic Wars, you'll find that there was a lot of that going on about, well, how much resolve, how will the Tsar really stand and fight? If
Right.
because, is that really the kind of regime it is? So, while I disagree with you that it's an artifact of the Cold War, I will gladly agree with you that for certain peculiar reasons during the Cold War, it became more important than ever, especially in conditions of limited information.
Right. And we should at least, and I did go over this with David earlier, but the political science critique of reputation is not that people don't think reputations are important, right? Political scientists are usually willing to grant that people think reputations are important, right? the political science critique coming out of John Mercer and Daryl Press and others is that people just don't get the messages you're trying to send, right? When you're trying to send a message of resolve, it is as often as not misunderstood on the other side. So what basically you're trying to communicate resolve, the other side doesn't understand that you're trying to communicate resolve in the way that you want them to understand. That they tend to misinterpret your messages.
Well,
that's the critique even with iterated games, right? And that's a critique you can actually take all the way back to Thucydides, right? You can even identify, like,
absolutely.
He says reputation is important, and here's somebody misunderstanding what we were trying to convey as important.
Oh, without doubt. My beef about the way political scientists now do their work in general is, how do we know that that's true? Well, we take a lot of cases, we code them in a certain way, mm-hmm. Which of course is a highly subjective activity in and of itself. And then we aggregate enough data to say, see, it didn't really matter. The problem is that gives you an outcome that is intuitively conflicts with the experience of policymakers who say, look, I mean, if you go back, I just spent, a good 6 months, about a year ago, it took me about 6 months to wade through an entire volume of Foreign Relations of the U.S. Mm-hmm. that I had to write a review on. So it was Foreign Relations of the U.S. 1974 to 1976, right? The bad days.
Right.
And, it was amazing to me that in the interactions between the Ford White House, which enters international relations crippled by by Nixon's resignation, by the 1970s, right? By the stagnation of our economy and so on, that the Soviets really do act as though reputation really does matter. And that when we can't confront them about things like Angola, when we can't confront them about things like the Soviet nuclear buildup of the mid-70s and the SS-18s and the other problems that we have, it's very clear that they see that as, you can be rolled. And you take that and match it against the memoirs of later Soviet figures. One of the things that always I found striking in the memoirs of Anatoly Dobrynin, who wrote his memoirs back in the 90s, he said, and he's writing about this period in the 70s that now has just been declassified on our side. So we can now, again, do that thing where we're matching up what we've got in our documents, what they've said. And Dobrynin said, we had entire meetings in the Politburo about things like the Third World where we simply didn't take the Americans into account. We just didn't even bother. Now think about that. Think about how reputation matters to the point where, not in a crisis, not in a discrete moment, because I think that's the other place where the political scientists try to have their cake and eat it too. They say, well, reputation overall doesn't matter, but in a particular discrete instance, credibility and resolve can really – so to me, that argument sounds like reputation doesn't matter except when it matters. But this was a more general kind of problem of the decline of American commitment, particularly starting with the end of Vietnam, starting with the retreat from the Third World, with the problem, in Angola and sub-Saharan Africa, where the Soviets said, we get it. They're out of the game. Screw them. And you see Kissinger telling Ford, I've never been treated with such arrogance. I've never been treated with such disdain. They don't listen to a word I say. Then we find out that in the Politburo meetings of those declassified minutes and memoirs, that's exactly the problem.
Doesn't some of it just come down to, I do not doubt that that Soviets felt confident and that Kissinger felt insulted, right? But then how do you boil that down to some sort of meaningful foreign policy outcome in the end, right? Other than just these, guys like Kissinger who, don't like feeling like a fool in a meeting.
Well, right? That comes down to counterfactual history. And
we all have to do that, right? We have to. So,
which I'm okay with, by the way. I think counterfactual history is really important.
Right.
But you know how political scientists feel about it.
Right, exactly. Well, we should go back a step here and say that, after having, critiqued Mearsheimer and Walt, that Mearsheimer and Walt are actually very much on your and my side with respect to this and their understanding of political science, right? That they're also very negative on the quantitative turn and the rational choice turn in political science. Although a lot of the people you would not hold to Ezra Klein's claim, and that I similarly would not hold to it, that political scientists are conquering Washington. And maybe add to that, and they shouldn't conquer Washington. That would be a disaster.
Well, part of the problem, I mean, let's get into this, because I think there's so much that in terms of kind of defining first principles that we have to think about. When I read that Klein piece, a couple of things occurred to me. One is, when he says political scientists, he means Americanists, right, not IR guys.
People who study voting behavior.
Exactly. Right. And people who have training in number crunching and polling, who of course are always valuable to campaigns and as consultants, the people who know how to make the magic of the numbers happen. And I'm not saying that that's a pseudoscience. I mean, I think that's actually really hard science. Is this
well,
kind of
they are generally right, right? There is a lot to them
exactly.
That's generally right. So,
so when he's talking about are people listening to political scientists? Well, if he means campaigns and politicians are always listening to people who know how to crunch polling data, well, who's going to argue with that? That's true by definition. The problem I have is, we're now to the point, and I, you know, Steve Seidemann and I have been hitting each other over the head with bats for weeks over this. Even though, again, like you and Steve and I, we tend to agree more than we disagree on some of this stuff. We're now to the point of saying a political scientist or political is anyone who's walked through a political science department at some point in their lives.
Right.
There are people I worked with when I was at Georgetown as a grad student back during the Stone Age. I was teaching assistant to Madeleine Albright and Jean Kirkpatrick at the same time. Talk about bipartisanship, right? So I was grading Albright's exams and Kirkpatrick's exams at the same time. The one thing I can tell you both about Kirkpatrick and Albright is that as regards the discipline of political science as it stood even in the 1980s, neither one of them gave a hoot about it. Not a bit. And so when people say, well, look at the influence of political scientists, Madeleine Albright, I mean, maybe Secretary Albright's going to contradict me tomorrow, but in the years I worked with her, Madeleine Albright didn't care a whit about political science.
Right.
Didn't care about the journals, didn't care who was doing the cutting edge work. She taught modern foreign governments. She taught about how does Ethiopia work. Kirkpatrick actually created the reading list for comparative methodology for people doing their comparative comps. But that was very much a 1950s, 1960s epistemological. I remember reading things that I really enjoyed reading, like Charles Jones's Doing Before Knowing, right? Do you generalize first and then do research? Or do you research induction versus deduction? But political science, as it had emerged from the revolution of the late 1970s into the 1980s, these were people who had served in the White House, and they couldn't have cared less about political science, even though in theory they could count as political scientists. I mean, to take a modern example, does Condoleezza Rice, you know, I once in a puckish moment, not that I would ever do this, you know, because I'm not that kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I am, let's face it. But in a puckish moment, when a group of folks at APSA were saying, you know, females are underrepresented in our governance, minorities are underrepresented in our governance, and I piped up and said, well, one of our most prominent minority female political scientists is Condoleezza Rice. How about her? And the reaction, you could see this kind of throat clearing, uncomfortable sort of, because A, they didn't like her politics, but B, she's not really a political scientist. She doesn't do that work.
Right, right.
She just doesn't do it.
I have two stories. I have two stories to compete with the story you just told. The first story is very short. I actually not only used but cited her book on the Czechoslovak military in my dissertation. So I was familiar with her work even before the Bush administration.
What did you think of the book?
It was okay. It was. It's
one of the reviewers, I knew one of the guys reviewed it. He said, it's a good book, except all of her evidence proves the opposite of her thesis.
Right. Yeah, that's not unusual in political science. There are lots of it's hard to publish negative fallout findings. And, you do what you can. Almost exactly the same situation. It almost makes me wonder whether we were at the same party. a gathering at APSA where people are drinking cocktails and wine, and you have a group of sort of older male political scientists who are talking about the Bush administration. And this would be in 2001, so it would be a little bit before everything really went down. You sort of go around the room, and there's sort of general agreement that it's a very interesting foreign policy team that's coming in, right? That, you know, we may disagree with Cheney, but, you know, he's competent, he's smart, right? We may disagree with Rumsfeld, but he's competent, he's smart. And then gets to Rice, and it's very interesting from the point of view of these political scientists who they're like, yeah, right. No, she's none of that, right? Which you sort of take, and it could be true, but at the same time that you're using this in terms in reference not only to someone who's a woman, someone who's a minority, someone who's not like you, but someone who's the only political scientist that we're talking about, if we don't count Dick Cheney's graduate school career, who, although he is absent, he's in the American Political Science Review, which I am not. So,
he's one up on both of us.
Right, exactly. But that, she was still subjected to like this same sort of negative appraisal when these other people were not. It was very fascinating, interesting to me.
But Rob, I mean, she comes from my tribe, right? I mean, I actually intersected, I probably met her once or twice in the early days when we were both coming out of graduate school because we're roughly the same age and she was maybe a year or two ahead of me. And, you know, I'm going to say that this is my professional opinion as a political scientist, as a practicing political scientist. Her work wasn't very good. I mean, she's just not, her work on Russia and the former Soviet Union, I don't think was particularly good or interesting. So I think that the evaluation of our colleagues of saying, yeah, Rice, well, she wasn't. Well, then I think any fair reading of her work is that it was, mediocre at best. But my bigger point is there are people who nonetheless claim her and say political science is relevant because, Look, Condi Rice. Well, Condi Rice is not by any means a mainstream political scientist and does not in any – there is no evidence that Condi Rice has any interest in the modern discipline of political science. And I think we have to
– And there's not any indication that anything that was part of her work as a political scientist then actually made much of a difference with respect to how she conducted her job either at NSA or the State Department.
And I think part of the problem for us is that political science, for people that are interested in policy – political science has to be the default major. It's where you go. Because
especially for foreign policy, right? I mean, there are public policy departments that do have a much more domestic orientation, but in terms of foreign policy, you know, there is, but you know, where I work, right, there is a growing, I like to refer to it as an archipelago, there is a growing archipelago of policy-oriented schools, which are distinct from political science departments, even if they are inhabited mostly by political scientists.
But that should have been, to me, that's a sign that is the canary in the coal mine, and this started about 25, 30 years ago, that was the canary in the coal mine that something was going very wrong in political science. Mm-hmm. I was graduating from Boston University when they established a Department of International Relations. Now, part of that had to do with BU's internal politics. Mm-hmm. John Silber was trying to get at Howard Zinn, and you know, there was that tactical nuclear exchange between Silber and Zinn that went on every day. But nonetheless, there was also this sense that if you were going to do exciting work in international affairs and have policy relevance to international affairs, you had to establish a separate school because the political science departments had become unreformable.
Right.
And it wasn't just at BU. It happened at Georgia. It happened at Stanford. It happened at Harvard. It happened at Hopkins, where suddenly the people who wanted to be in the game, people that wanted to study foreign policy and have an effect – had to hive off departments away from the traditional political scientists. I don't think that was good for political science.
Well, basically what happened at Kentucky. It is essentially what happened at Kentucky. The story is a little bit different, but yeah.
I think Georgetown, I was talking with one of my colleagues at the War College, a guy named Mark Genest. Mm-hmm. Genest and I are both Georgetown products. And we were saying, and I ended up finishing up at Georgetown, but I sojourned through, I actually started my grad program at Columbia, and then I spent a year at Harvard, and then I finally went and finished my dissertation at Georgetown. And Mark and I both said, you know, it's amazing that Georgetown, which still had a department of government rather than a department of political science, we both felt was one of the most well-rounded educations that we had gotten. That, you know, I remember my department chair sitting me down and saying, you may want to study Soviet guns and bombs, but you know if you can't adequately discuss Plato's Republic, you're just not a well-rounded political scientist. And I took that away as a very important lesson. And somehow that's being lost. I mean, I find narrow. I'll tell you a quick story about somebody I taught with many years ago who's still in the profession. But when I was at Dartmouth, and you know, I Dartmouth went from being a very traditional kind of ecumenical teaching department to trying to be cutting edge.
Right.
And I probably didn't help my tenure case at Dartmouth when I said at one point, maybe we ought to just ban the term cutting edge from our hiring discussions because, you know, you were supposed to do that. But we had a person there who's a Europeanist, and at a dinner party, somebody turned around and said, well, what do you think of the Euros? This is the Euro. What do you think the introduction of the Euro is really going to do here? And she said, oh, I don't know anything about that. I don't study that kind of stuff. Now, this is the person who's supposed to be their Western, because it was a narrow, this is what I do, and politics, Euros, you know, currency reform, elections, that I don't do any of that stuff. Right. It's also the same place where I was talking with a well-known IR scholar there who said, and I've repeated this story on Twitter many times, well, I don't understand, you know, this is, by the way, where I part company with people like Mearsheimer, mm-hmm. Who said, well, I don't understand what you comparativists are all about. Comparativism is you study one country and you don't compare it to anything. And he said, I don't understand that. You don't need to speak Korean to understand Korea. And I was so floored by that comment that I find myself now in the I feel homeless in some way in the formal discipline of political science, because on the one hand you have the quantitative guys who are, you know, who've been called Leninists, that they are so, you know, determined to take over their departments. And then on the other side you get the John Mearsheimer billiard ball guys who have no interest in comparative politics. I thought Mearsheimer's last article on Ukraine and Russia was ghastly.
It was
wrong.
I
can't believe it got published.
Well, I assigned it. I assigned it in my John, if you're watching, then these are opinions. I assigned it in my European world politics, European institutions course, essentially for those reasons, because it's like, this isn't good, right? You could have published this in The Nation. That was also what was weird to me. You know, did Stephen Cohen edit this for you?
Just to add the professional gossip here, you know, and if Mearsheimer is watching or anybody else, this is not classified gossip. A colleague of mine ran into him at APSA or whatever the last conference was, and he said, yeah, the people he reads on Russia are Stephen Cohen and Nick Petro, who an old friend of mine, you know, that I've known him, he teaches here at URI, I've known him for 20-something years, but I think he's gone completely off the rails. He's a complete Putin, not a Russophile, he's a Putinist. Mm-hmm. And apparently Mearsheimer told this guy, those are the two best writers on Russia, Cohen and Petro. Those are the two guys I would have picked as completely unreliable, you know, partisans in this. But why does Mearsheimer choose them? Because they service the theory. And the theory, and this is my overarching critique of political science, the theory has become more important than actually explaining real stuff. That we're all about determining whose theory is ascendant over whom. And policymakers couldn't care less about that.
Tenure is one on our theoretical contribution, right? Promotion is one on our theoretical contribution. So
the incentives in the discipline are perverse.
They're terrible. I have to cut us off. This has been fantastic. If you have time in the future, we would love to do another one of these. I'm sure that the people are going to love it. So, Tom, thank you so much for appearing. Foreign Entanglements viewers, all several of you, thank you also for watching. And any comments you have are always welcome. Facebook page, we have one, everything else. So thank you so much.